Hello everyone and welcome to a very special edition of My Classic Album. This is 30 Years of Hysteria and I'm Mike Norris. I'd like to thank you very much for tuning in, be this your first ever episode of My Classic Album or whether you've been listening to us for a year now. We started the podcast back in August of 2016 when we talked about the Beatles' classic album Revolver, and since then we've covered albums from the likes of Bob Dylan, Radiohead, Kiss, Arctic Monkeys, Joni Mitchell and everything in between. So, yeah, this is the start of the second year of My Classic Album. So, if you enjoy this episode, 30 Years of Hysteria, by all means, get yourself to www.myclassicalbum.co.uk and listen to the past year's worth of podcasts. We only do a podcast a month, although this month's slightly different. I'll get to that in a little bit. So, there's plenty of time for you to catch up on some fantastic albums, some fantastic guests that I've been really lucky to welcome, and get yourself all ready for hopefully another fantastic year of guests and albums here on My Classic Album, and I know how the next few months is going to look, so you are in for a treat. So before we get started proper, I'd like to dedicate this episode to two very special people. Now, this isn't something that I usually do, but July has been quite a significant month for me in a lot of ways, and it's important to me that I kind of honour these people at the beginning of the episode, and that this episode will be dedicated to them. So the first person that I'd like to dedicate this episode to is my daughter. So anyone who uses the Facebook page or knows me personally will know that my wife has just had a beautiful baby girl on the 7th of July. And her name is Eleanor Jane. And we couldn't be happier. It's just an indescribable feeling, as I'm sure any of you who know who have had a child or children. And I just wanted to take an opportunity to dedicate this episode to her. There's a picture on the My Classic Album Facebook page of her wearing a Queen baby grow. which my wife had bought me for my birthday, or her for my birthday, if you like. And there's a Kiss one too, and, you know, music, we're a very musical house. Not that we particularly have any talents musically, but my wife's a fantastic singer, and I just love music, as I'm sure you've guessed, so she'll grow up in a house full of music and happiness. At least that's my hope anyway. So I just wanted to dedicate this 30 Years of Hysteria, the first episode that's kind of around since she was born. So this episode is for Eleanor. But also on the other side of the scale, if we're talking kind of, you know, the beginning and the end of life, I wanted to dedicate this episode to a good friend of mine, Trevor Dawson, who is a work colleague of mine, and he sadly passed away in July, just a few days after Eleanor was born. And the reason I'm honouring Trevor is because he's kind of, without even really knowing, he's one of the reasons that I started this podcast. So I would sit next to Trev 8 hours a day, and we would talk about music. He saw the Beatles in Wolverhampton. And he always made me laugh when he told me that story, because he would say, you know, we would talk about the Beatles, and he'd said, oh, I saw them in Wolverhampton in 1963. And I'd said, oh, so what were they like? You know, you've got someone there who saw the Beatles. And he'd said, honestly, I couldn't hear a bloody note, because I guess it was just so, you know, I mean, seeing the Beatles full of, like, screaming fans, and he said he couldn't hear any of it, but it was an experience that he got to see the Beatles. He absolutely loved Electric Light Orchestra. He was a huge Queen fan. He liked Elton John. And in fact, at his funeral, which obviously I went to towards the end of July. And funerals are a funny thing, aren't they? But we walked in to the crematorium and they were playing Mr. Blue Sky, which made me smile because my association with him, despite him being a work colleague, is our chats about music. They also play Rocket Man by Elton John. And then at the very end, which was very kind of fitting to his character, they played Fat Bottom Girls by Queen. And being a huge Queen fan, as you all know, that it just kind of raised a bit of a wry smile on my face, because I thought, you can't encapsulate someone any better than those three songs. And it was just a very fitting tribute to Trev, but I wanted to pay one of my own. And as I said, you know, he's a driving force of this, because I love talking about music with people so much, and Trev is one of the main people that I did talk about music with, and I thought, is there a way that I can translate this into a podcast? Like, does that work? And I'm happy to say it did. So I felt like it was a really nice opportunity to pay tribute to Trev and, of course, to Eleanor, and dedicate this 30 Years of Hysteria episode to both of them. I'm not sure if Trev was a fan of Def Leppard, actually. That's a good question. It's a shame I can't ask him that now. But I'm hoping that Eleanor will be as she gets older. Now I've kind of got the tributes out of the way, I guess it's just time to get started talking about one of my favourite albums of all time. But it was actually Rob Wild, who's the lead singer of Tiger Tales, who chose to do Hysteria today, and it seemed like the perfect opportunity with the anniversary coming up to celebrate it in a really big way. Rob and I aren't alone with our love for this album, as I'm sure you know, you're all listening. What I think's great is that, you know, obviously when I announce these episodes, some albums are more popular than others, you know? And Hysteria, the reaction that we've got for doing this Hysteria episode has been absolutely huge. You know, I posted a post just promoting the episode and what was going to happen, and the response I got from it was incredible. You know, Def Leppard fans are really fiercely loyal, and it shows, because Def Leppard still headline festivals to this day, they still release albums, go on massive tours in the UK and the US, and there was just a really huge response to this episode. So I really hope that everyone who kind of heard about it has had the opportunity to listen to it. Phil Groom said, "Animal is my favourite song ever. Nobody in Luton had heard of Def Leppard, so I took some of their records to a headbangers pub and got the DJ to play them. Animal, Pour Some Sugar on Me and Photograph. I had a black t-shirt with Def Leppard written on the front in white letters. People came up to me in pubs and said, 'What is Def Leppard?'" And then we've just had so much comments like, "Darren McKernan, awesome album. Stacey Bork, grew up listening to Def Leppard and got to see them a few times. Good times." Matthew Stevens says, "It's a great album." Dennis Porter, "Love Def Leppard, one of my all-time favourite groups." So I hope that all you Def Leppard fans really enjoy this episode of My Classic Album, because Rob and myself are huge fans of Hysteria, and I really hope that comes across in our conversation. What we've also got coming up is I put a post on My Classic Album page asking people to vote for their favourite track from Hysteria. So we'll have the results of that coming up as well. But I don't see why we shouldn't just get down to business. Let's get on to our chat with Rob. So Rob Wild, lead singer of Tiger Tales and Midnight City, has chosen Def Leppard's Hysteria as his classic album. But before we get to my chat with Rob, let's just look at the facts. Here's everything you need to know about Hysteria. The 3rd of August 1987 saw the release of Hysteria, the fourth studio album from Sheffield rock band Def Leppard. Recording began in February 1984, but frequent Leppard collaborator Mutt Lange was initially unavailable as producer, and it was acclaimed songwriter Jim Steinman that stepped into the producer's chair. A series of events, including the dismissal of Steinman as producer and a car accident that cost drummer Rick Allen his left arm, meant the production of the album took over 3 years. Phonogram Records had all the albums released in the UK, while Mercury Records did the honours stateside and in Japan. With Mutt back at the helm, he and the band aimed to record the hard rock equivalent of Michael Jackson's Thriller, leading to an unprecedented 7 singles being released from Hysteria. While album opener Women had a lukewarm reception in the US, it was Animal that broke the band in their native UK, reaching number 6 on the UK singles chart. Animal's success was only the beginning. Third single, Pour Some Sugar On Me, reached number 2 on the US Billboard charts, and a string of hit singles followed, including power ballad Love Bites, as of recording, the only US Billboard number 1 single for the band. With an arsenal of singles resembling a greatest hits album, Hysteria reached number 1 on both sides of the Atlantic and certified 2x platinum in the UK. Hysteria's diamond certification in the US contributed to worldwide sales of 25 million, placing it amongst the best-selling albums of all time. Critically, Hysteria was seen as the blueprint for the burgeoning glam metal scene, and has been held in high esteem ever since. Rolling Stone placed the album 464th on their 500 greatest albums of all time, while a similar chart from the magazine called Hysteria the greatest hair metal album of all time in 2015. So that's just about everything you need to know about Hysteria so far, and I have here with me my special guest who's going to help me celebrate 30 years of Hysteria, Mr. Rob Wild. How's it going?
How you doing, mate?
Very good, thanks. So, on the 3rd of August 2017, Hysteria will be 30 years old. Why does Hysteria stand out for you as such a classic album?
You know, from literally from the first track, I think from Women onwards, I think it's just a landmark album. I think it just sounds completely different to any other album from that genre of music, you know, and I'm the sort of walking encyclopedia of like 80s hair metal, you know what I mean? I absolutely love all that stuff, but it's just such a completely different, you know, sounding album. I think obviously a hell of a lot had to do with you know, with Mutt Lange, and I think a lot of that sort of direction came from him. But, you know, still to this day, I don't think there's any album that sounds anything like Hysteria. I think so many bands after that tried to remake Hysteria, and, you know, I don't think anybody, you know, was capable of doing it. It's just as soon as you know the first track hits, it's just in a completely different league to everything else that sort of came before it or since, really, you know.
So what are your memories of hearing that album for the first time, and what made you fall in love with it? I know you've talked a bit about how it kind of stands on its own and there's no album that sounds quite like it.
Yeah, I mean, I was 10 when Hysteria came out. You know, at the time I was, before sort of, you know, getting introduced to sort of bands like that, you know, I was, you know, my sister got me into Duran Duran, who was kind of like my first sort of favorite band, I guess you'd say, sort of before that. And then, I remember in 86, I remember hearing Europe and Bon Jovi for the first time, which suddenly sort of, suddenly it was all, you know, forget about Duran Duran, it's all about, you know, these kind of bands that sounded like that, you know. And of course, back then there was, you know, there's no internet, and, you know, I was too young to kind of have heard of magazines like Kerrang and stuff like that. So the only stuff I was really subjected to, or the only stuff that was getting through, was the stuff that was popular, you know, stuff that was getting in the charts and the stuff that was on the radio on Top of the Pops and stuff like that. So it was Bon Jovi in Europe in 86, and then 87, you know, Hysteria came along, which was just kind of, again, you know, I remember hearing, I think it was Animal was the first single, which I heard on like Radio 1 or something. I was just like, oh, what is this? This is just incredible. And, you know, I didn't really know anything about them, you know. I started seeing them in, you know, magazines and stuff, and with the kind of weird name, with spelt wrong and all that kind of stuff. So I was really into it straight away. So then I think the album came out maybe a month or so after that. And so, yeah, I was like 10 years old when I heard it for the first time, but it was just such a, you know, a great time, you know. And it's just an amazing album. You know, I can't say it enough. You know, the amount of times I've listened to that album is just ridiculous, you know.
Absolutely. And when I came up with the idea for this podcast, Hysteria was one of the main albums that inspired me to do it. So not only is the album like one of the most loved and best-selling in music history, it also has this like incredible story of a band fighting against adversity to then reach the pinnacle of their career. So there can't be many albums that have a VH1 movie made about their production.
Yeah, I saw that a while ago. That was it was a good movie and it was a bad movie all in one. Yeah. I especially liked how all this stuff was filmed in America, and they were trying to make it look like they're in a pub in Sheffield, you know, they're in the middle of California or something, you know. The Dutch accents as well. I think the Steve Clark was like Irish all the way through it. I'm like, what the hell's going on? But you're right. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Do you think that the trials that Def Leppard went through while they were recording this album, does it inform the way you listen to it? Or do you think the music just kind of stands on its own?
I think, you know, to me as a little kid, you know, I mean, I knew nothing about, you know, 87 and Hysteria was my introduction to Def Leppard, you know. So I'd never, you know, obviously from there, then I kind of backtracked and I, you know, bought the early, bought Pyromania and the early albums. But to me, you know, I knew nothing about all the awful stuff that had happened. I just, you know, the first, you know, to me, you know, it just sounded amazing on the radio. And the first time I actually saw him was on Top of the Pops. And that was like, what's with the guy with one arm? You know? And then I started reading about, you know, all the things that had happened in the leading up to it, and Rick's car crash, and, you know, learning to play the drums again. And then, you know, but at the time I knew nothing about that. So for me, it was just, you know, I was just sold on how amazing the music sounded and how incredible the songs were, you know.
Now, there is a lot to get through, and it seems the best way to kind of cover it all is just to start at the beginning.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, so in 1983, Def Leppard are coming off the back of another hugely successful album that you've touched on there, Pyromania, and they're getting ready to get in the studio to record what would become Hysteria. Now, for every Def Leppard fan who loves Hysteria, I'd wager there's another who would opt for Pyromania instead. They're both huge albums. How do you find the albums are different, and what does Hysteria have for you that perhaps Pyromania is missing?
That's a good question. I mean, I love Pyromania. I think Pyromania was one of those albums that kind of changed the way bands sounded in the 80s. You know, before that, I think everything was quite, in the early 80s, it was still quite, stuff wasn't all that well produced. And I think Pyromania came along, and then suddenly, you know, everybody wanted to kind of get on that sound. Everybody was using the drum machine, the big drum machine, and you know, from, you know, bands like, you know, a year after that, like, you know, the Rat album, you know, Invasion of Your Privacy and stuff like that. Everybody was trying to kind of cash in on that kind of Pyromania sound. And you know, I think there's some great songs on Pyromania, some absolute classics, but I think it Hysteria to me, they just took it to a whole other level. And I know that for a lot of the more kind of diehard Def Leppard fans, it turned a lot of people off. You know, they kind of went super poppy and super, you know. I mean, they're already overproduced on Pyromania, but then they kind of took it up another level. But I think there's a lot more depth to Hysteria as well. I think when you really get into the songs, especially stuff like, you know, Gods of War and... again, the songs lyrically were a lot deeper, and I think they just kind of they dug in further, you know. They kind of set the bar up really high for the Pyromania, and then they just kind of just went completely over it for me, you know. So even though I love Pyromania, you know, I think Hysteria is just from start to finish, you know, a much more sort of cohesive sounding album, really.
And what I think's really interesting is I've recently been rewatching the documentary series Metal Evolution. I don't know if you've seen that. And it kind of... Yeah. So it kind of like tracks that history of heavy metal. And what's really interesting is Def Leppard's role in that, that they kind of moved away from this like new wave of British heavy metal sound that like Maiden and Judas Priest had kind of kick-started to kind of get into this kind of slick, produced, Mutt Lang sound and the success in America that came with that.
Yeah, they did. I mean, they said from the start, I mean, they were never, you know, a metal band. You know, they weren't. They were influenced by, you know, a lot of 70s, you know, glam, UK glam stuff, you know. So they were always a lot more influenced by, you know, the pop stuff, which I am as well. You know, I do not like metal at all. I'm a real sort of like pop metal guy. You know, I'm all about the melodies and the big production and the big choruses. And I think they were always, even the early stuff, even though the early stuff was a little more primitive, you know, the first couple of albums, but, you know, even on High and Dry, there's some big songs there, you know, some big choruses, which, you know, and especially, you know, lyrically as well, they weren't, you know, the Iron Maiden stuff, I just always thought was just kind of a little bit silly, you know, and the whole macho, you know, were kind of like, you know, talking about... I don't know, Dungeons and Dragons and all that kind of crap. It just completely went all over my head, really. I think, I think Def Leppard also always had kind of like quite an American sound, even quite early on as well. You know, I think, High and Dry and you know, Bringing On the Heartache, you know, I think there's a lot of songs on that, you know, if you didn't know, you were probably, I don't think they sound, you know, like compared to, say, for example, some of that new wave of British heavy metal, like a band like Saxon. I think as soon as you hear a Saxon song, you instantly know that they're a British band. You know, you kind of almost know what they look like, you know, before you know, when you've heard the song. And it's kind of, you know, not that there's anything wrong with that, but, you know, I think Def Leppard from the start of the career had a big foot in the kind of American radio rock sound, which obviously they developed and they, you know, developed big time for Hysteria, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, Mutt Lang, the producer, is a huge part of the sound of these albums that we're talking about, High and Dry, Pyromania, Hysteria. How important is he in developing that iconic Def Leppard sound that we're talking about?
I think he was massively, massively important. I think, without him, you know, Def Leppard wouldn't, you know, don't get me wrong, they were a great band, but there's no way in a million years they would have ever become the band that they became without Mutt Lang. But, you know, I think there's a lot of bands like that, you know, kind of, you know, they're lucky enough to have that kind of huge name that gets involved. You know, like Bon Jovi's another classic example. You know, the first two albums didn't really do anything and they weren't really going anywhere. And then suddenly they get in the biggest songwriter on the planet at the time, Desmond Child, and suddenly they become the biggest band in the world. You know, Desmond Child was a massive part of breaking Bon Jovi, and you look at like all the big Bon Jovi signals are all co-written, you know, through Desmond Child. You know, it's no secret why they became as huge as they did. And I think Leppard kind of the same, you know, without Mutt, I mean, I think they would have continued to release great albums and write great songs, but I think he just made them think in a whole different way, you know, especially, it was started with the Pyromania thing where he said, well, you know, why can't we have as many hit singles on a rock album as Michael Jackson can, you know, and stuff like that. So I think he really kind of probably trained their ears to really focus on the pop side of things and basically what, you know, the average person on the street wants to hear, you know, on the radio. You know, they don't want to hear like a, you know, 12-minute song. They want to hear like a 3.5-minute great rock song with, you know, a huge chorus that's going to stick in your head, you know, for days. So I think it kind of maybe fine-tuned and maybe kind of took off some of the more sort of rough edges that they probably had earlier on. And I think they just sort of defined it as well, you know, just and added his kind of his magic to it as well, I guess. So, but he was without a doubt a massive part in you know, their success, without a doubt.
So, of course, the first stumbling block, talking about Mutt, that Def Leppard would encounter would be that he would step away from the project initially, citing exhaustion, only to be replaced by Jim Steinman. So Steinman, as we know, is most famously known as the man behind Bow to Hell by Meatloaf. Now, even as someone who... Now, Meatloaf, I love Meatloaf. Bow to Hell is actually my favourite album. Even as someone who loves Meatloaf and Jim Steinman, even I have to admit that this maybe wasn't necessarily the best fit.
No, I don't think so either. And I knew nothing about that, again, until sort of years later that, you know, he kind of started working with Leppard, and then he, like I said, he kind of bailed on it. And I just can't... I mean, there's nothing wrong with that album, you know, and he was, again, one of those guys that we were talking about, you know, Desmond Child and Bon Jovi and Mutt Lange and Leppard. You know, Jim Steinman was, you know, the kind of a big part of breaking that Meatloaf album and making it such a huge album. But I can't imagine how that would have panned out, really. I don't know. I mean, it might have sounded pretty good, but to me, the two didn't add up for me. So, you know, thank God Mutt Lange came back on board.
And it's funny, guitarist Phil Collin recalls that they went with Jim as he was the only producer out there that they'd kind of heard of at the time. Jim's vision for Hysteria was wildly different to that of the band's. Song-wise, he didn't really get what we were trying to say, Phil said, and we were so inexperienced, we didn't really know how to do it ourselves. Obviously now it's a totally different story. I do the stuff on my laptop, but even the sound of the band, he didn't quite get what we were going for. How important is it as a musician to get that right producer in the studio with you?
It's really important. It's really important because, you know, a producer is a very, very... you know, he becomes a member of the band. I mean, I've just kind of touched on it briefly. I've got a new band called Midnight City, which got an album coming out in October. And it's, you know, a very, you know, if you love Def Leppard, you're going to love this album. It's very, you know, 80s melodic rock hair metal style. But, you know, the guy that, you know, I've been working with on that album, you know, he's also the drummer in the band. But initially he was just producing, producing the album. But, you know, he was hugely, you know, important in getting the sound. You know, I mean, you know, the songs that I've written, they're all my songs, but he's equally as important, you know, to shape the song, shape the sound, get the right vibe going. Producers are massively important. And I always tend to think when bands sort of, you know, produce themselves, it's never usually, or think they can produce themselves, it's never usually a good thing. You know, I think you need that kind of extra person that's kind of going to look at songs in a different way and say, well, this is cool, but why don't we try doing this? And why don't you try kind of, you know, adding this line, or why don't we try this? And sometimes, you know, ideas can, you know, be a disaster, and you know, you try them and they just completely don't work. But then sometimes, you know, those little ideas or those little sparks can just kind of completely take the song off in a completely different direction. And producer is massively important to any album. You know, and you know, when you got someone like Mutt Lange behind it, you know, you're pretty much in good hands, you know.
So on New Year's Eve 1984, drummer Rick Allen was driving down the A57 with his girlfriend when he lost control of the car and he crashed into a brick wall. His seatbelt became undone, and as he was thrown through the sunroof, he lost his left arm. By any standards, that is a horrific and life-changing injury. Surely the initial thoughts of most people would be whether he'd even survive that, let alone play drums again.
Yeah, I mean, that was just, the whole thing of, you know, also, I mean, it's not just the fact that, I mean, it's a horrible thing to happen to anybody, you know, I mean, like I said, completely life-changing. I mean, that would finish a lot of people off, you know what I mean? But the fact that he was also a drummer was just sort of like doubly sort of cruel, really, you know, I mean, you know, if he'd have been a singer, you know, not that anybody wants to lose a limb, but, you know, a singer, but to actually be a drummer, you know, and especially in a band that is just really starting to take off and their sort of careers, you know, I guess at the time, probably all their dreams were just about to start coming true, and then to suddenly be given this horrible blow. But how he got his head right, especially, you know, you don't realize when you look back how young he actually was. You know, when he, you know, this wasn't a guy, you know, even in his late 20s, he was like, I don't know, he was 20, 21, 22 when this happened. So, I mean, when you're that age, you know, you're still kind of a baby, you know. And to actually just get your head of, just around that, you know, around losing a limb and being a drummer. And then to actually have the balls to actually say, well, you know what, I'm going to play drums anyway, I'm going to find a way of doing it, is just absolutely, you know, remarkable. It shows like such an amazing spirit, you know. It's, you know, and when you see him play, you know, I mean, he's, you know, I remember the first time, you know, I said I was a kid and I heard about it, and I used to think, well, he's probably not really playing drums, he's probably just sitting there. But, you know, you watch him playing, you know, he's really doing it. And I mean, it must have, the amount of patience and time and energy he must have put into being able to even just play sort of a basic beat must have been incredible. But then to actually learn all the songs and to go out and play for 2 hours every night, I mean, you know, guy's incredible. He really is.
Yeah, and I mean, to touch on that a bit more, he was talking to Classic Rock magazine last year, and he said, coming around in hospital after my accident, I was told I would be there for at least 6 months, but I had a lot of visitors, including Mutt Lange, who lit a fire under my ass, and some Hare Krishnas who brought really healthy food each day. In the end, I left within a month. That just gives you the idea of the kind of person. When incredible is almost the perfect adjective for it, you know?
Yeah, oh, definitely, without a doubt. I mean, he was just a... What an amazing human being, you know. And just to get through all that and to come out the other side. And, you know, I think if anybody deserved to have that massive, massive album that Stevie became, I think, you know, Rick Allen definitely deserved it just on his own, you know.
Modern Drummer magazine spoke to Rick in 1988, so we're talking just a few years after the accident. And he revealed how he's got a very unique drum kit these days, as we've kind of touched upon. And he'd said that the hospital staff put this big piece of foam rubber at the foot of the bed to stop me from sliding down. I could push myself against it to hold myself up. And as I sat there, I eventually started tapping away on it, thinking, yeah, that could come in handy. I was working out ideas with my feet. There were a few things that were a bit difficult, because I had only played a single bass drum, so it took a lot of concentration to get my feet working right.
Yeah. I mean, I think I remember reading about that, and he basically just sort of replaced what he was playing with his left arm, which was obviously all the snare drum stuff, with his left foot, you know. So, you know, the science behind it kind of would, you know, and obviously has worked in theory, but it's all the other stuff, you know. It's fair enough just doing a straight 4/4 rock beat, you know, replacing, you know, his left leg with his left arm with his left leg, but, you know, then you've got to do drum fills and stuff like that. So, you know, like I said, the amount of time he must have put into that, you know, just to get it up to a very, very, almost like a beginner's drummer level, just to get to that level must have taken just such a lot of effort, you know. But it just shows you just how unbelievably focused and how unbelievably determined he was to get through it. Because most people, you know, you're a drummer, you've lost your arm, that's the end of your drumming career. You know, I mean, not Rick Allen. You know? So he, I guess he just refused to, you know, he refused to lay down and take it. He was like, no, I'm gonna work it. I'm gonna work on this until I get it right. You know, and I think he's an inspiration to anybody, really.
And we've touched upon how difficult it would be just to get back to a basic drumming standard. But both Rick himself and Joe Elliott have said that they think he's actually a better drummer since the accident. Is that something you'd agree with?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I remember, you know, especially on the early stuff, you know, he used to play with a matched grip, which is how he played his snare drum. There's kind of like the basic way of holding your drumsticks. And he would use this method called match grip, which is almost kind of like what maybe you see kind of like marching bands, you know, just a completely different way he held his stick, which I always thought was kind of really strange. You know, you don't tend to find that it being used in hard rock music. But, you know, I mean, you listen to the stuff he does now. I mean, yeah, I would agree he's probably better than he than the stuff he was doing, you know, on the first two albums, really. And the great thing is, you know, he does the fills, you know, he doesn't just do, you know, you'd be tempted to kind of just play it very, very basic and very, you know, not really do too many tom fills and stuff like that. But, he, you know, he's like any other drummer, you know, he would never know that he'd lost an arm, you know, which is, I suppose, the thing that, you know, I suppose he was after. He just wanted to be accepted as a drummer, not a drummer with one arm. So it obviously worked. So
absolutely, yeah. So the band hit the studio once again. Mutt's finally available now. Having said that, he had a car accident of his own. Joe Elliott recovered from about a mumps. And so finally the album's gaining traction. Phil Collins told Guitar World that Mutt and the band, as you were touching on earlier actually, were aiming to make Hysteria a hard rock version of Thriller. The fact that with Thriller, you had an R&B artist who crossed over not just into pop, but into everything, even rock, with Eddie Van Halen playing on Beat It. That really appealed to Mutt and to us. But I think without Mutt's vision, the record would have been a more standard-sounding thing. He definitely pushed it. I think we've discussed a little bit already. Do you think they succeeded in kind of pushing it and having this kind of hard rock Michael Jackson's Thriller?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, I think you know, he just had a great vision that, you know, I think a lot of time in rock music and hard rock, there's very, very much sort of boundaries, as in, you know, you record an album that is just going to appeal to this crowd of people. And then, you know, say for example, like an Iron Maiden album will appeal to just the metal guys, and a pop album will just appeal to this person and that person. I think his vision that, you know, why can't we appeal to everybody, you know, which is such a, you know, when you think a bit about it now, it's kind of like an obvious thing to think, but nobody was really sort of thinking like that back then. It was very sort of segregated as to the audience that you had. So, you know, again, like touching on Iron Maiden, you go to an Iron Maiden show, it's all metal guys, you know, it's all a certain type of person that will go and see that band, you know. But then he said, well, why don't we just appeal to everybody? Why don't we can still get the metal guys in, you know, we can get some girls in that probably weren't, you know, wouldn't have listened to that kind of music otherwise. You can get younger kids in, you know, like me, you know, I was 10 when I first heard Hysteria, you know, and I was a massive fan. So they just completely broadened, you know, their audience went from, I guess, probably like a little small box into this huge amount of people, you know, every different walk of life, young people, old people, metal guys, pop guys, you know, girls, kids. And, you know, it's no surprise that it appealed to such a wide range of people. When you listen to the album, there's really something on there for everybody, really. And I think that was his vision. He just wanted to appeal to as many people as possible. And that in turn turned into a huge selling album. I think that's the key. I mean, if you're going to have a massive, massive album, that album has got to appeal to a huge array of people and not just one sort of audience, you know. Otherwise, you do, which is great. I mean, back in the 80s, you know, a lot of those hair bands would sell, you know, a couple of million albums, which was great, but they only sold that many because, I guess, it was just that one kind of audience, you know. And this thing was, you know, just exploded, you know.
Yeah, and it's interesting, all that stuff that you're talking about, and Phil Collins, a lot of the quotes that I've got come from him, he's talked so much about this album. He'd said, when Hysteria first came out, a lot of people went, dude, this is lame, this isn't rock, it's pop, it's wussy. But actually, it had the absolute effect it was supposed to have had, because the point was to not just play to the rock audience, but rather to play to everybody. And we achieved that. And I mean, the album went diamond, as did Pyromania, and I think that in itself, kind of everything we've been talking about, that demonstrates the success of the album and how it's just become an absolute behemoth of an album.
Without a doubt, totally agree with you, mate.
So now seems a good chance to go track by track. So we'll start off with Women. Women was the first single from the album in the US and Canada, at least. In comparison to other singles released from Hysteria, it didn't really take off. It reached about number 80 on the Billboard charts. Why do you think Women failed to resonate with the music buying public in the way that later singles would manage to?
I always thought Women was, I mean, I think Women's such a great song, but I never thought it was a very good single. You know, I didn't think it was a, you know, compared to, I mean, they ended up on this album and it was just seven hit singles, which is just completely unheard of. You know what I mean? What rock band releases seven? You know, they weren't just, you know, they did okay. They were all massive singles. But I think there were other songs on the album that weren't released that probably would have made, you know, a better single. You know, I think they probably should have, you know, released Rocket first, which would have been the obvious song. To me, I always thought it was a strange choice of a first single. But you know, as a song, I think it's a real builder of a song. You know, it starts out kind of, as soon as it kicks in, you kind of, you know, like I touched on earlier, that it's a kind of a different sounding album to anything else that was around, you know, especially in 87 when there was, you know, some great albums that year, you know, which, you know, I bought all of them, but, you know, all big albums, you know, like Whitesnake, 87, and Kiss, Crazy Nights, you know, Appetite for Destruction. You know, there was a lot of big Motley, Girls, there was a lot of big albums, but just as soon as, you know, Women kicks in, you know, you know you've got a completely different sounding album. It's on a whole other level, really. And I think the song Women just kind of builds and builds and builds, and they do the classic of, you know, which is a trick that, you know, a lot of people use. I use it every now and then as well, where you kind of, you know, you've got a good chorus, so you sort of like hold back. So instead of doing, you know, your verse, bridge, going into the chorus, after the bridge, you go back to a second verse. So you sort of keep people waiting, and then bang, you're into this, you know, huge, monstrous, you know, chorus. And that's really when the song lifts off. I think initially it's kind of a bit of a slow burner, which I think maybe is why it didn't wasn't instant like a lot of the other songs on the album. So I think, I mean, by the time it gets to the chorus, then it's a single, but I think it takes a while to get there, you know, so it's kind of like a slow burner type song, but I absolutely love it. You know, I think the chorus is, like every chorus on this album, is just absolutely monstrous, you know. And I think the lyrics as well, the lyrics are quite cool. I think there's, on this album in general, I think again, that's probably a lot to do with Mutt. I think he told him to kind of maybe rework some of the lyrics and stuff. And I think, I mean, with a song like Women, I mean, you could imagine, like, you know, like Motley or somebody doing a song like that, but it's not really cheesy, and it's not kind of all the cliched lines. It's kind of, again, it's almost like a more intelligent way of writing your stereotypical song about girls, you know what I mean? So it was really clever, I thought.
Yeah. Now, Billboard.com says of Women that, in hindsight, it's not hard to figure out why the album's first single didn't really take hold. Though the production is rich, the harmony spot on, and the melody ironed to crisp perfection, it all sounds a bit messy and rhythmically turgid, something less than the sum of all its parts. The guitar solos hold up, but Women started the album at a trot, when a sprint was really required. Do you think that criticism's harsh, or do you think it is easily lost beneath the weight of An Animal or A Pour Some Sugar on Me?
I think it's a little bit harsh, but I think also, you know, one thing you got to do when you're making an album is, you know, you've got 11, 12 songs, and they've got to be placed in an order. You know, when you're putting a running order of an album together, it's like putting a running order for a set list together, as in you've got to kind of, it's got to have its peaks and its troughs. You know, it's got to kind of, you know, if you're doing a ballad, then your next song's got to be a rocker to bring everything back up. And then you don't want too many ballads together. You want to kind of, you know, there needs to be space and placement, you know, and that's very important with a running order of any album. So I think now, you know, I think it sets the album up. Like you said, you know, in that description, it doesn't hit you straight in the face. But, you know, when you get to the chorus, it's suddenly, wow, okay. And I think it almost kind of entices you in as to, okay, right, there's going to be more of this. You know, I best keep listening, sort of thing, you know, because I've got a feeling there's going to be even bigger songs later down the line, which obviously, you know, there are. But yeah, I think that criticism's a little bit harsh, you know. But I think, you know, when you've got so many amazing songs on an album, you know, I think it's hard to, you know, because everything's so incredible on the album that it's when one song isn't bang straight instant in your face, then people probably might start saying something about it. But I still think it's a great album opener.
So we'll move on to track two, which is Rocket. Now, we've touched on that briefly there, that could have been a great first single. I would say it's one of their most iconic songs, a tribute to their glam heroes. Rocket's a 6.5-minute epic and one of the best examples of how Mutt and the band had pushed the boundaries of the studio. What are your thoughts on Rocket, and is it a better example of what's to come for the rest of the album?
I think it's definitely a better example of what's to come. And I remember hearing that again on the radio and as a little kid, and I'd never really heard anything that kind of sounded like that, you know, the drum beat and stuff, which I think now as I've got older, you listen back to it and it kind of, it's got a little bit of sweet in there, you know, Blockbuster kind of that kind of thing. But at the time, I don't think any band was doing, you know, there was no drum beat like that. There was no sort of nothing that sounded like that, you know. And then they really, really went to town on the production with, you know, with the samples and everything and all the rockets going off and stuff. And I remember as a kid just thinking, I remember, you know, listening to, I used to have to listen to, you know, my cassettes on my headphones, you know, quite a lot, you know, because I used to kind of stay up and listen to all my albums in bed and stuff. And the stuff that was going on in your headphones, I was like, whoa, you know, every time I heard the song, I heard something else. I'm like, you know, all the backwards kind of vocals and just the midsection where it just all goes off into this, you know, just insane world of, you know, late 80s Mutt Lange production. You know, I'd never heard anything like it at all. But I think the chorus is an anthem. You know, I mean, it's just an absolute anthem. You know, it's just incredible. You know, I mean, and I think the lyrics as well, I thought were really clever. Like you say, you know, they I remember hearing Joe Elliott talk about it, and he said, "Well, why don't we just, you know, name check all our influences, you know, so we go through from, you know, Bowie to T-Rex, Mott the Hoople." And again, lyrically, I think they were kind of thinking outside the box a little bit, you know. Again, maybe that was probably down to Mutt, you know, maybe saying, "Why don't you think about doing something a little bit more clever rather than just straight ahead, you know, Rocket, you know, and all the rest of it." So, but I think that was such a great song. And I remember the video being really cool as well. I like the video. It's very, very kind of big, kind of late 80s American MTV production video. And I thought the video was really cool and exciting as well, you know. What a song.
And I like, I mean, to use a modern term, it's obviously not a term that was used at the time. There's almost like Easter eggs with the songs and the albums that kind of backmasking at the start is from Gods of War, and there's little kind of samples from Love Bites that's coming up later on as well. Phil Collin told Music Radar, "I feel that Rocket is the absolute pinnacle of Def Leppard. It sums us up in a nutshell. Massive drums, massive guitars, big choruses. Is this the band's creative peak in terms of in the studio and what they can do with the studio?"
I think so. You know, I think that and also Gods of War, which comes later on in the album. I think just in terms of what they did with that song, because when you actually listen to the actual song itself, I mean, it's, you know, the chorus is three chords, you know. I mean, you play it on acoustic guitar, it's just three chords. But to take that and turn it into what it became was just like a masterclass in production, you know. And I think that literally had quite literally everything but the kitchen sink, and, you know, on that track, you know, I think they put it all on that one, you know. And it's just an incredible, incredible song. And I think, like I said earlier, I think that definitely should have been the first single.
So, you know, there's bands and singers referenced, as we've touched upon, you know, Queen, David Bowie, The Sweet. We often forget when we're discussing kind of glam metal and hair metal, the influence that the glam rock bands had on those bands. How important are people like Queen and Bowie in shaping that Def Leppard sound? I particularly kind of go to the harmonies straight away when I link kind of Queen and Def Leppard together. Harmony's the first thing that comes to mind.
Yeah, I think they were hugely important. I think, you know, you listen to Queen, and I mean, that's where the harmonies came from. It was, you know, the Queen stuff, because, you know, the glam stuff, they weren't really massive harmonies. You know, Queen were a band that was all about harmonies. And again, you know, back in the kind of the early 80s, you know, there weren't that many bands. I mean, Boston would, you know, did that, you know, did huge harmonies, and Journey as well, but there was only really those two bands that were really going for the massive, massive, massive vocal harmonies. And I think Queen were a massive influence on that. You know, without Queen, I don't think you'd have had Def Leppard. And I think that the glam side of thing was just kind of the feel of the songs. Because, I mean, you know, as an image band, I mean, Def Leppard never really had an image, and they certainly didn't have a glam image. But I think it was the kind of, just the kind of sentiment and the energy from those. And also the poppiness, because, you know, you listen to T-Rex, you listen to The Sweet, Slade. I mean, they're all massive, you know. I mean, Slade were a massive, massive influence on Kiss, for example, which I, you know, never knew until recently. One of Paul Stanley's favorite bands. But again, you know, it's not hard to see why, because they were just massive pop choruses, you know, which all that 70s glam was, you know. And then I think they just took the Queen harmonies and just kind of put it all in a blender and just kind of supersized it for the 80s, really, you know. And I think that's kind of in a nutshell what they did with Hysteria in general.
And we're only just getting started with Rob Wild talking about Def Leppard's phenomenal album Hysteria. We've got the rest of the album to go through track by track, but before we get to that, I just want to read a couple of comments on the Facebook page again about Hysteria. So I posted something on all the social media channels basically saying Hysteria is my classic album because ... and wanted you guys to finish it off. So Mark Schoenberger said, it was the second album I bought on vinyl. Since then, it's one of my favourite records of all time. Which is an interesting point, because obviously they're re-releasing it on vinyl, as well as some kind of super deluxe 5 CD, 2 DVD collection of Hysteria, which I'm guessing has B-sides and outtakes and all sorts of stuff. I've got a deluxe version on CD somewhere or other, but obviously this is going to completely trump it. But the vinyl version being re-released, this time as a double album, because I know that when I talk to people about albums on vinyl, people always said to me, Hysteria, there's no point listening to it on vinyl. You need to get it on CD. The sound quality is just naff. So I'll be very interested when my copy arrives, obviously, with it spread out over two records, how that'll sound. But I think it's really cool that, you know, people did buy it on vinyl. But I think we were just kind of getting to that point in 1987 where it was all CDs. So it's really cool that 30 years later, the vinyl edition is what a lot of Def Leppard fans are getting excited about, me included. So just another comment about Hysteria on Twitter. Paul Burns completed my sentence, Hysteria is my classic album because, with the sentence, it succeeds as being both perfect and honest. It's the best pop metal album ever recorded. There remains no excuse for Excitable, though. We're going to be talking about Excitable and all the other tracks on Hysteria in just a little bit. Coming up, which song on the album do I think may still have a bit of Jim Steinman's influence? And do Def Leppard really want Jesus to go to hell? All that and more, right after this.
They'd never done anything like this album before, ever. There was such a mix of stuff on it.
Would you like to get involved with the discussion on my classic album? Or maybe you'd like to be a guest on a future episode?
I don't think there's any other album that is so poignant and so human in its lyrics.
Like us on Facebook by searching for My Classic Album with Mike Norris. Alternatively, you could follow us on Instagram at My Classic Album Podcast, or even tweet us over at MCA_podcast.
This music is inside of me, and I couldn't not be influenced by it if I tried.
But at the time, it blew my mind, and it blew millions of people's mind, and that's why it's my classic record.
Make sure you never miss an episode and keep up to date with all the latest news at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk.
Why is whatever people say I am, that's what I'm not, your classic album, and why should people check it out?
It was amazing, that's why.
So I feel like if any song's production best personifies the story of Hysteria, it's Animal. So the song took nearly 3 years to put together, yet it's arguably the slickest and most perfect piece of pop metal, like, in ever, let alone on the album. It's the track that finally broke them here in England. What is it about Animal that made it such a huge success?
I think just, again, because it's just a perfect, like, you hit the nail on the head, just a perfect, perfect pop rock song on every level. I mean, that was the first song, like I said earlier, that I ever heard Def Leppard. You know, I heard it on the radio, and just as soon as the intro kicks in, I was just like, who the hell is this? And what is this? I need this in my life. And just the gloss, it's got this beautiful sort of gloss about it, you know, the mix of the clean guitars and just just the whole thing, you know. I mean, the chorus again is just, I mean, every song on this album is, you know, the chorus is a to die for, but it's just the perfect, you know, it's very AOR, you know, it's I would say it's probably one of the more AOR songs, and just perfect for sort of American rock radio, and the fact that it did well in the UK was great. But I think the reason it did well in the UK was just because it was so poppy, you know, and it was, you know, at the time, you know, in 87, 88, I mean, kids were listening to, I don't know, Jason Donovan and Kylie Minogue and stuff like that. But, you know, it's as catchy as songs like that, you know, there's a reason why, you know, kids went out to buy it. There's a reason why girls went out to buy it, and metal guys went to buy it. You know, parents liked it. You know, my mum and dad loved that song, you know, so... And they're like, you know, in the 70s. So I think it was just a perfect, you know, if there was ever a template for how to write a perfect pop rock song, that is it in a nutshell. You know, but yeah, it's just an incredible song.
And just to lean more on kind of the pop side of things, I've read a few interviews that suggest that Def Leppard took inspiration from bands like Frankie Goes to Hollywood. That seems to be the main one that comes up when putting Animal together. Can you hear that kind of inspiration on a track like Animal?
Yeah, I can. You know, I mean, again, you know, a lot of the 80s pop stuff was great. You know, when you actually listen to the songs, I mean, I wasn't crazy on, you know, some of the looks. I wasn't crazy on some of the production. But when you actually listen to the songs as pieces of work, there's some great songs. There's some really, really great songs. You know, Duran Duran had great songs. There's so many people from that kind of era, which was all around the time Hysteria, you know, kind of the mid 86, 87, you know, Nick Kershaw, Tears for Fears. I know they were big fans of Tears for Fears as well, by the way. So, you know, they were just, again, they're just focusing on writing great melodies, which is basically what sells, you know. Great melodies will always, you know, good catchy choruses will always, you know, get people on board with what you're doing. And I think it was cool, you know, that they weren't just saying, okay, well, let's just go back and listen to our old Queen albums and our old T-Rex albums. I mean, that influence will always be there throughout what they do. But I think it was cool that they said, well actually, yeah, this Frankie Goes to Hollywood song is great. Why don't we try and put some of that in it as well? You know, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And obviously, it clearly worked.
So we'll move on to Love Bites. So, Def Leppard's first and currently only number one single in the US. When it was released in 1988, the power ballad was king. We've talked about that a little bit. Love Bites is rousing, it's heartbreaking, it's extremely melodramatic. Is Love Bites the ultimate power ballad?
I think so, yeah. Again, you know, we've kind of got the ultimate sort of four-minute pop rock song in Animal, and I think Love Bites is the ultimate, you know, power ballad. I think in the 80s, I mean, that was what... that was pretty much what broke all the hair bands. You know, they released the rock song, and then the second single will always be the ballad, and that would be the one that would, you know, usually sell an album, you know, from, you know, I mean, you know, Poison, Every Rose, to Heaven Warrants, you know, Home Sweet Home, Motley, Skid Row, I Remember You. I mean, we could go on forever, you know, but I think all those songs, as great as they were, you know, and a lot of those songs are fantastic songs. Again, I think Love Bites was just on a whole different level, you know, on every level. You know, I think lyrically as well, I think the lyrics are really clever. Again, not just kind of doing your stereotypical, you know, kind of cliched lines. I think they really went to town lyrically on it. I mean, it's one of the songs, you know, it gives you goosebumps, you know what I mean? I mean, and any song that does that is, you know, gold, you know? So I think, I mean, you listen to the pre-chorus, and that's, you know, that's kind of in itself is like a chorus that any band would die to write. And they haven't even got to the chorus yet. It's just like, oh my God, this is incredible. And then it goes up another level to the, you know, the chorus, which just completely takes off with the lead, you know, Phil Collins' lead guitar line underneath it. I just think it's just and also really clever as well. I remember in the second verse, I think a lot of this, again, I think probably a lot of this was coming from Mutt Lang, but there's a really clever little thing in the second verse where the kind of bass drum and the snare drum are kind of reversed. So, you know, usually on a like a 4-4 song, you'd have your kick drum on 1 and 3, snare on 2 and 4, and it's actually reversed. So it's kind of the kick drum's on 2 and 4, which is kind of like, you know, and it's only years later when you listen to it, you think, well, that's really clever, because, you know, it's just not something you would think of doing. You know, it's completely reversing how you would, a drummer would naturally play that beat. You know, again, they just really went to town on the production. I mean, the harmonies are just heavenly, you know what I mean? It's just got this beautiful sheen around it, which is just, you know, I mean, it's no wonder it was a massive single in America, you know. I mean, it's probably one of my, I'd say probably my top 5 favorite songs of all time, you know, just incredible.
And I mean, obviously we've talked about Mutt's kind of contribution a little bit. If you consider that Mutt also in the future would go on to work on power ballads like Everything I Do It For You by Bryan Adams, or Still the One by Shania Twain, it would make sense that he'd be heavily involved in such a huge power ballad like Love Bites. It's almost kind of a precursor for the next 30 years worth of power ballads.
I agree. Totally agree.
So there's also, deep amongst all that kind of power ballad stuff, a huge country influence. So the AV Club saved the song. By the time it appeared on Hysteria, Love Bites had been remade into an archetypical late 80s heavy metal power ballad, bolstered by Leppard's characteristically creamy and spotless harmonies. But beneath the big hair and outside emoting is a song that sounds like a cousin of Love Hurts by Nazareth. Lang famously made country songs sound as big as 80s metal anthems with Shania Twain in the 90s, but he was already honing that method in surprisingly subtle ways with Def Leppard several years earlier. Again, we've already touched on this a little bit. Is it kind of a blueprint for kind of the whole, that kind of country pop ballad Shania Twain sound that he would perfect?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think if you listen to, you know, the country stuff, you know, the last 10 years, to me, I mean, it's 80s rock. You know, it's just played in a different, you know, it's played differently, you know, but it has all the elements of what bands like Def Leppard and Bon Jovi were doing, you know, which was just writing great melodies, you know, which is, I mean, all that country stuff is great for, you know, the melodies are awesome, you know, and there's some great, really great songs from that genre of music. And, you know, I think, you know, I mean, there was, Taylor Swift, who was like a massive, you know, that Def Leppard was her favorite band when she was growing up. And, you know, she's stated, I think Lady Gaga's stated that Def Leppard were a favorite band as well. I think even Katy Perry said they were a big influence. So I think a lot of the stuff we hear today, when you hear those massive choruses, those massive pop choruses, they've come from Def Leppard, you know, they've come from this album and Pyromania, you know. And I heard that the country thing as well, you know, it kind of started out as more of a country song, and it was kind of like reined in as to push, you know, towards more the kind of 80s herb ballad. I think it's very much that Def Leppard and bands of this genre are very much responsible for kind of a lot of the stuff we listen to today.
And before we move on to the next track, this is one of my favourite things about Love Bites, is that it's always been a bit of a victim of controversy due to the last few seconds of the song, where the voice allegedly says, "Jesus of Nazareth, go to hell." Have you heard that part?
I know. I remember hearing about it, again, not until years later, and then I started trying to, you know, turn the volume up right at the fade, and I can hear something. I don't think it says that, but, you know, it's one of those classic, you know, what does he say? Does he say this? Does he say that? You know, but it is quite funny. There's a lot of things like that, you know, on the album throughout, you know, all the vocal samples that are kind of, you know, played backwards and stuff. And you can, if you really want to hear anything, you can pretty much make, you know, you can make it sound anything. It says anything, you know what I mean? There's so much going on. I know what you mean. I've heard it, but I'm still trying to figure out what he actually says. So.
I think it just makes me chuckle that you've got kind of, obviously at the time there was a lot of controversy around Ozzy and Judas Priest and all these, like, who are very much pure metal performers who, and all this stuff about, like, you know, kids being told to kill themselves and this, that, and the other. And then Def Leppard, of all people, apparently have Jesus of Nazareth go to hell.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think even if they had have said that, anybody would have believed it coming from Def Leppard, you know.
Exactly. So our next track, another huge track, Pour Some Sugar on Me. The last track recorded for Hysteria, Joe Elliott was playing guitar during a studio break and was overheard by Mutt, who felt the album was missing a strong crossover hit. How important is Pour Some Sugar on Me for the success of the album and the enduring legacy of Def Leppard?
I think it's hugely important. I mean, that was a single that really made them. I mean, they're already massive in America anyway, but I think this was the one that really kind of set them on a whole other level, you know. I mean, this is kind of, if you're talking about, you know, a hair metal anthem, this is it. I think so many bands after this song came out, I mean, so many bands tried to rewrite Pour Some Sugar on Me. You know, so many bands. I mean, if you listen to, you know, Cherry Pie by Warrant, I mean, it's a great song, but it's basically just Pour Some Sugar on Me. You know, it's a blatant attempt to kind of rewrite. You know, so many bands tried to do it because it was such a big success, and it was such a, again, like Rocket, an anthem, you know. And I think, again, there's a big kind of Queen influence, you know, because you can hear a lot of We Will Rock You, you know, throughout Pour Some Sugar on Me. You know, I think they kind of wanted to write that big anthem. And it also became apparently the number one stripper song for like in American strip clubs, apparently. It's like the number one requested song. Just as a song in general, it's a lot of fun. You know, the lyrics are really, you know, tongue-in-cheek. And it's just an awesome song that everybody's tried to, you know, like I said, everybody tries to rewrite it, but fails miserably, you know. But the only one thing the downside, I would say, was the, I remember seeing the UK video where they're kind of in the house that's being demolished and just thinking it was just like the worst video I think I've ever seen. They all looked absolutely awful in it. And then I think I remember reading something about it that, you know, they put this single out in the States, and apparently their record label saw this video and said there is no way on this earth that this video will ever be shown on MTV. So they basically redid the video, redid a live video, which was kind of the in the round sort of audience kind of video with all the girls and the big, you know, in the round stage and everything. And it kind of, like I said, really made the album take off big time in America. I think this was the one that just kind of set them on their way to, you know, being probably the biggest band in the world at the time. I think this song was pretty much, you know, because it's got all those classic elements like We Will Rock You, and it's just got all the right elements to, you know, that those songs had, you know, the anthem, the, you know, again, three chords on the chorus, you know, the big harmonies, the kind of the chants, the real kind of crowd participation type song. So it was a very important song for the album. Like I said, it was written right at the death, but I think definitely, again, I think helped sell the album.
And jump back what you were touching on about kind of it being a stripper song. Phil Collin attributes its success to that. He said, it's funny, the album came out and kind of tanked, but the strippers in Florida started putting this song in their routines. They loved dancing to it, it totally worked, and they would call up the local radio stations and ask them to play it. That's what got it all going. Before you knew it, the song took off like wildfire all over the States, Canada, everywhere. So it was the strippers in Florida who put this one over. Isn't that something?
Yeah, exactly. They got, you know, they've the strippers have got a lot to answer for.
Yeah, and I mean, I know you've talked about kind of that, the links to We Will Rock You and that as well, and I hear a lot of kind of I Love Rock and Roll by Joan Jett and the Blackhearts in there as well. Have you heard of a band called Rock Sugar by any chance?
Yeah, I have. I know another band.
Yeah, so Rock Sugar do this awesome kind of, for anyone who doesn't know, Rock Sugar will take two songs, usually kind of like a heavier rock song and more of a pop song, and right, mesh them together. And they have a fantastic song called I Love Sugar on Me, which is basically they've pushed I Love Rock and Roll and Pour Some Sugar on Me together, and it really works.
I've not heard that one. I heard the I think they did Journey and Enter Sandman.
Metallica.
Like, Metallica, yeah, that was it. That was cool. I'll have to check that one out. I've not heard the Def Leppard one. That's cool.
So our next track is Armageddon It. Many interviews with the band cite a huge T-Rex influence on this one. Joe Elliott called Armageddon it T-Rex meets Eddie Cochran with backing vocals, while Phil Collin called it an ode to T-Rex in the Bang A Gong style. Is that kind of element obvious when you're listening to Armageddon it?
It wasn't obvious to me when I was a little kid. It is now, because as I got a little bit older, you know, I started kind of, like I did with a lot of bands, with Kiss and a lot of bands, when you sort of read who were their influences, you become curious as to, oh, well, you know, because at the time, you know, all I was listening to was 80s rock. But, you know, I started kind of going back and, you know, buying T-Rex albums and buying Slade albums and Sweet albums, just to kind of see, you know, that's so Def Leppard or that's so Poison or whoever, you know, and you can hear where the influences have come from. I think, looking back at it now, I can hear the kind of T-Rex sort of influence. For me, this was, I remember seeing the video for this, which was, again, like a live video. I'm not sure whether this came out after Porsum Sugar on Me or not, but I remember seeing the video. I had no idea that they were such a big band, you know, because in the UK, as we kind of touched on earlier, I mean, they never really broke that big, you know. I mean, Animal was a big single and the album did well, but, you know, not to a level of, you know, when I remember seeing the video of them in the round and they're playing, you know, to like 40,000 people. And, you know, I remember thinking, whoa, you know, I didn't realize there was such a big band. And that video, I love the video, you know. It's just, as a little kid watching that, you're just like, oh my God, that's what I want to do, you know? But I think on the album, I mean, every song's amazing, but I think I would actually say this has probably got one of the best choruses on the album. You know, the actual chorus is just so good, you know. And it would be up there, you know. It's probably one of the top three choruses on the album. Again, lyrically, I think it's quite clever. Again, thinking outside the box a little bit tongue in cheek. And it's quite a simple song as well. It's quite a straight ahead song. It's, you know, whereas, you know, Love Bites is very complex and you know, stuff like Rocket, there's you know, the samples going on. I think this is just a bit more kind of straight to the point. Let's kind of, you know, just kind of get to the chorus and blow you away. And there's not too much. I mean, it's still an amazing production, obviously, but there's not too much to detract from the great melody of the song, you know.
So this song particularly reminds me of guitarist Steve Clark. The name, after all, is a pun based around a studio conversation that he had with Mutt. Are you getting it? Armageddon it. And then Joe's ad-lib of Come On Steve before the solo. Can we just take a minute to talk about Steve's role in the band? Because obviously, sadly, he passed away in 1991, but he was a huge part of the band up until that point.
Yeah, oh, he was, without a doubt. I mean, he was responsible for a lot of the, you know, the early stuff, especially. But, you know, a lot of stuff on here, you know, I mean, this song and Gods of War, you know, he's very kind of, very prominent on that song as well. And to me, he was the total rock star in the band, you know, apart from the playing style. I mean, he was the guy that looked like the rock star, you know. I mean, it was great as Def Leppard were, they never really, when you compare them to kind of how bands looked in the 80s, they were never the coolest looking band, but Steve Clark always looked like the total rock star, and his playing style was so different to Phil Collins as well, which I thought was so great. You know, you got Phil Collins, who's just this incredible kind of 80s shredder, I guess. You know, it totally comes from that kind of Eddie Van Halen, Randy Rhoads type background, and then on the other side you've got Steve Clark, who's just kind of a bit, you know, sloppier, you know. I mean, his guitar was right down his knees. I mean, he wasn't, you know, like a virtuoso, but he's just, his rhythm playing was just incredible, you know, and the lead stuff he did was just, he just had his own sound, which I think all great guitar players have. Their, you know it's them when they're playing it. There's some really cool stuff that obviously he didn't play on because he died by that point, but on Adrenalize, is like a song called White Lightning, which was a song that it was mainly written by Steve Clark before he died. And again, it's got these melodies that are really very defined by, you know, his Steve Clark and, you know, and his sound. He was a very, very important part of the band, without a doubt. And, you know, you think, you kind of wonder where things might have gone, you know, if he'd still been alive, but it was certainly a very important part of the band.
And we've touched on this already, that he's a huge part of driving force on our next track, Gods of War. And we've talked about this a few times since we started chatting. It's the first track on the album that wasn't released as a single. If we're talking vinyl, it was the start of side two. And I think side two has a lot more kind of deep cuts than side one. It's a very political song, and it's very heavy lyrically. Phil Collins says of the track, "The song had literally like three choruses. We just kept adding parts to it and it worked. There were a lot of things going on in the world at that time. We were still dealing with the Cold War and it was still really scary." Now, a song that's that heavy thematically and lyrically has to appeal to a different audience than, say, Pour Some Sugar on Me.
Yeah, I would say so. It's funny you talk about side one and side two, because to younger people, they'll be like, "What?" But that was, again, really important. You know, when we were talking earlier about placing an album, you know, you're always going to think about what's going to end side one and what's going to start side two. And you know, it was side two on the cassette, you know, and so you've ended it with this kind of tongue-in-cheek, light-hearted, you know, song, Armageddon. And then, you know, I remember kind of the intro starting for Gods of War and just thinking, whoa, okay, this sounds quite dark, you know, with the big E minor chord and again, completely different to anything else on the album. It's probably one of my favourite songs off the album, just for that reason. You know, it's so different musically, lyrically, like you said. It's quite a dark, quite a serious song. When, you know, a lot of the album is lighthearted, you know, Pour Some Sugar on Me, Love Bites, Excitable, songs like that. But they really, really dig deep lyrically on this. And, you know, I think as well, you know, the samples with the marching feet and, you know, Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan's speech at the end of the song. And it was kind of, it just, again, it was a song that nobody, I don't remember any of the rock bands around that time doing a song like Gods of War. And it's just, I mean, it's just a massive, massive, massive song. I think another really clever thing, again, you know, I don't think they ever really got credit for what they did musically, you know, on this album. But again, you know, it switches from major to minor keys constantly throughout the song, which is quite a, you know, again, not an obvious thing to do. You know, it's in, I'm not entirely sure what key it's in, but it certainly switches from major to minor keys about three or four times during the song, which is, like I said, just really clever musically and without a doubt one of my favourite songs on the album.
So we've talked a lot about kind of getting to the chorus and kind of how the chorus is such a, like a huge part of the song. Phil Collins, somewhat critical of the song when he was talking to Goldmine magazine, he said, "We listened to the album one time when we were at Joe's house and we admitted that we really didn't get this one right. It was really going good, but we fucked up on the chorus." Do you think that the song loses steam on the chorus, or would you tend to disagree with Phil there?
Oh, I definitely disagree, yeah. I think the chorus is great, you know. I think, because again, would it be a more kind of a serious type, you know, lyrical matter? I think, you know, the main line, you know, "We're fighting for the gods of war, what the hell are we fighting for?" I think, you know, that line's really, you know, especially the "what the hell are we fighting for" is like a very important and powerful line, you know. I mean, it was stuff that I didn't know about because I was a kid, you know, I didn't know what was going on with the Cold War and all that kind of stuff. And it's stuff that you only kind of learn about when you sort of get a little bit older. But I think that line in general was like a massive line. And I think that the chorus is absolutely perfect for the song. But like, you know, it's true that there's potentially another kind of three chorus. That was the thing with, you know, Def Leppard. I mean, like I said, you know, I touched on Love Bites earlier on. I mean, the pre-chorus sounds like a chorus, you know. It's just so good. But I definitely disagree. I think that the chorus is killer.
So we'll move on to Don't Shoot Shotgun. Now, I feel like Don't Shoot Shotgun gets a bit of a hard time compared to some of the other tracks on the album. ClassicRockReview.com calls this song the worst on the album and maybe the band's entire career. Is it really that bad a song?
I think Excitable's probably worse on this album. I don't think it's that. I think the problem that you've got with this album is the standard of songwriting, the standard of production, just the standard throughout is so unbelievably high. I mean, you put Don't Shoot Shotgun on another band's album, it would be the standout song on the album. But when you're fighting with Animal, you're fighting with Love Bites, you know, Pour Some Sugar on Me, this song is, yeah, it's not quite up there. But I think the cool thing with this, again, I think it's really well spaced out in that, you know, side two starts with this very serious sort of, almost like a kind of brooding type song, Gods of War, again, a very long song. And I think it's sort of a bit of light relief after that, that it's like, oh, okay. And it's just a straight ahead, almost. I always think it's almost kind of like a little bit AC/DC style. And it reminds me of a lot of the stuff from the High and Dry album. But I think it needed that after such a massive statement of Gods of War. I think it needs to kind of, you know, let's just hear, you know, a straight ahead, you know, good 4 minute rock song that isn't too crazy production wise and there isn't a million samples going on. And like I said, I think that song probably would have appealed to the earlier Def Leppard fans because it's a little bit more, just more of an AC/DC riff type song. But yeah, it's certainly not a bad song. It's just not quite up to the astronomical levels of the rest of the songs in the album.
And it's funny when you're talking about kind of track placement, because I was thinking back to a couple of other conversations I've had on the podcast in the past where there's a song on an album that people are like, oh, it's filler, it's rubbish, it's this, that, and the other. And the answer always seems to be, well, yeah, but think about the song that it's following, that you need that time to just kind of, especially with a track like Gods of War, you need that time just to kind of come down a bit and get back to the kind of...
Exactly, yeah.
More of a simple rock song, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So we'll move on to Run Riot. Now, this is a really interesting one for me, Run Riot. We talked earlier about Jim Steinman's contributions to the album, and as far as I know, there's very little out there as to what songs he worked on or this, that, and the other. There is a bit of talk about that Don't Shoot Shotgun, funnily enough, was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back, that he'd started working on that and they didn't quite get the sound they wanted for him, and that's one of the reasons he left. For some reason, I've always felt that he was potentially involved in the early stages of Run Riot. Are you familiar with much of Jim Steinman's work? And could you say where I'm coming from? Because I'm happy to explain, like, if not.
You know what? I'm not. I've got to say, I'm not too familiar much of his work, to be honest. No.
I always thought when I was kid, before I knew that Jim Steinman was even involved on the track, Run Riot, at the start of it at least, it reminded me very much of a song from Battle of Hell 2 called Out of the Frying Pan and Into the Fire. It's got a very similar kind of riff going on with it and just some of the kind of the arrangement of it. Now, obviously, Mutt and the band have done a lot more work on it before it became the track that we know it as today. But it just seemed interesting that, I mean, and Run Riot, as I'll get into, is probably one of my favourite tracks on the album. But interestingly, for me, it always seemed to have a link, and maybe that's something I'm just looking for because I'm a fan of that kind of music. Or maybe there is something there. It'd be something I'd be very interested to find out, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, there could very well be a link there. I mean, it's funny you should say that because I would say Run Riot is one of my favourite songs in the album. I think if I had to pick three, it'd probably be... we'll go to four. I'd probably say Animal, Love Bites, Gods of War, and Run Riot. I think Run Riot would have been a really good single as well. You know, I think a much better single than Women, for example. Yeah. I love the song because I think the verses are very, I mean, Joe sings in his kind of, he's almost like his sort of AC/DC type voice. He's really high, raspy, you know. I mean, it kicks ass. The verse really kicks ass. And then again, like they do many times in the album, you know, they don't go straight into the chorus. They go back into the second verse. So you're kind of thinking, especially when you've got that far into the album, you're kind of thinking, okay, this chorus is going to be worth waiting for. And then the chorus is just absolutely heavenly. You know, it's just such a great melody, such a great chord progression. And it's definitely, I mean, it's probably one of the I wouldn't say the heaviest, but the most sort of hard rocking song on the album, I would say, especially the verses. I think the verses are just great. And the verses are very kind of in your face and quite aggressive. And then it goes into this really lush chorus, which really takes the song off into, you know, a different level. But it's without doubt one of my favorite songs on the album.
And it's funny because when I often talk about favorite tracks on albums, sometimes the people that I interview are often very surprised by a track that I pick. So it's refreshing that Kevin, me and you are maybe on the same for this one.
Yeah, it's funny. I speak to a lot of people and they you know, and they're like, what, really? Run Riot? I'm like, yeah, you know, like, go back and listen to it, you know.
But yeah, I mean, you've summed up everything I love about it. Phil Collin, on the other hand, calls it the weakest song on the album.
Definitely not. I think there's probably I definitely would not agree with. There's at least three songs that are weaker than that on the album. I think it's a massive song, you know.
So we'll move on to certainly not a weaker song than Run Riot, the title track, Hysteria. It's held in very high regard by critics. The name came from Rick Allen, who thought it apt after all the hysteria in the press about his accident. And of course, it ends up becoming the name of the entire album. Classic Rock Review called it the most mellow song on the album. This unique and moody song is a true musical gem, not just on this album or by this band, but for the era in total. How does Hysteria as a song rank for you amongst the rest of the album, and indeed the career?
It's one of those, you know, landmark songs, I think. If you kind of to list your 10 big Def Leppard songs, it would definitely be in there. And I think you know, it's quite interesting that they ended up, that they named the album after the song as well, which is, you know, I don't know any other bands that have named their album after a ballad. You know, usually it's named after, you know, one of the rockier songs. But I think it's to me, Hysteria is almost like a timeless kind of piece of music, that it just transcends everything else. You know, it's such a beautiful song, and I don't know anybody that doesn't like that song. You know, I've got friends that are real, you know, metal guys that absolutely love this song, you know, and it's the only kind of slow kind of ballad song that they like. They think, you know, typical metal guys, you think anything that's isn't loud and aggressive is, you know, not worth listening to. But I know a good few of my friends who are into all that kind of stuff absolutely love this song. So again, I think it's that again is says something, you know. It's just a beautiful melody. I think the lyrics are great. I think again it's placed really well on the album. And I just think it's just a timeless piece of music, you know. That's, you know, the clean guitars are awesome. Just the whole thing. I mean, it's just a great song from start to finish.
So it was inspired by an acoustic riff from bass player Rick Savage, and the rest just seemed to fall into place from all accounts. This is the song where you get this often heard rumour that Def Leppard played every single note separately on the album and it was stitched together after. And I think that comes from the fact that so I've got a quote here from Phil Collin, who said, "On the Gotta Know Tonight part, we recorded every guitar string separately so that there would be no arpeggiating. Mutt said, I don't want a keyboard doing it, I want it on guitar. It had to sound non-arpeggiated, because even if you hit a power chord, there's a certain amount of that. But if you hit every note separately, it sounds totally different." So it's a brilliant sound. Obviously, this kind of hilarious room has come out of it. But you can't deny the results. You've said yourself how much you love that kind of clean guitar sound on the track.
Mm. Oh, yeah. I mean, that kind of makes the song, really. You know, I mean, the song is based around the clean guitar, the picking of the, you know, the clean guitar on the verses. And, you know, how you get to that final result is, you know, it's whatever floats your boat. But when you've got the results, you know, in front of you, and you're listening to how it sounds, I mean, it's, you know, I can very much believe that it was played note by note. And I think they spent, I think, over $1 million making this album. So, and a long, long time making it. So I think everything just had to be absolutely perfect. You know, a lot of times when you're making albums, you know, you don't have that luxury to, you know, sometimes you have to say, well, you know what, that's going to have to do, you know, but that kind of phrase clearly wasn't used when Leppard made this album. Yeah, I think the clean guitars really make the song. And I think, again, I think the pre-chorus on this song is probably better than the chorus, you know. Gotta Know Tonight, If You're Alone Tonight line, I think is just, you know, such a great, that's probably the best part of the song, really. It's certainly kind of a, like I said, a timeless piece of music that, again, so many bands tried to kind of replicate after it and, you know, didn't really come anywhere close to doing it.
So our next track, and we've touched on this a little bit, is Excitable. So Phil says of the track, "We wanted Prince meets Michael Jackson. There was also a song called State of Shock, which was Michael Jackson and Mick Jagger. So we were trying to get all of these dance things together." Have you heard State of Shock, and can you hear the similarities? I know I heard a version where it was actually Michael Jackson and Freddie Mercury, a demo.
No, I haven't heard that. I'll have to go and check it out. I mean, you can definitely hear the kind of the poppier sort of, it's very poppy, that song, and very almost kind of like danceable sort of, he's got a cool vibe, but I would say it's probably, for me, probably the weakest song on the album. But again, when you're in the company of the rest of the songs. Again, it's still a good song, you know, it's not a bad song. I think I always think that song is kind of a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek sort of throwaway type song. I know they definitely never sort of played it live or obviously it wasn't a single. But again, you know, it fits well, you know, after Hysteria, it kind of brings things up. You know, it's very similar to me. It's got a similar sort of vibe to Don't Shoot Shotgun, you know, it's kind of a straight ahead fun rock song. So yeah, I mean, it's still pretty good.
I mean, Phil's also been known to say that as the album was so long, tracks like this were their chance to experiment, and that in his eyes, Excitable's almost a dance track. Do you think it's wildly different to the rest of the album in that sense?
I don't think so. I think it's, I mean, when you listen to, you know, Pour Some Sugar on Me, I mean, that's very, very much sort of a dance sort of related, you know, obviously, you know, strippers, you know, they're not going to dance to something that isn't, you know, good to dance to. So I think it's got this similar kind of groove to Pour Some Sugar on Me, and even Rocket, because Rocket's got a, you know, great groove to it. I think this one, just in general, is very, very poppy, and I think the guitars are really kind of, even the guitar sound, the guitars are brought right back in the song. I mean, I can imagine if they'd given this song to, you know, some of the pop artists of the day, you know, Paula Abdul or, you know, someone like that, then this could have probably been a really big single. I think this, for me, was just a little bit, you know, I love overproduction, I love the big pop metal sound, but for me this was just slightly too far for me in terms of kind of pushing the pop envelope, you know, and that says something, because I'm like the king of cheesy pop rock, you know, but to me it was just a little bit too far, but like I said, it's still a good tune, it's still a good song.
So it's Classic Rock magazine this time that went as far as to rank Excitable as the worst song on the album. And they said about it, despite Mutt Lange's joyous rendering of Excitable's chorus, it's simply overpowered by the glories that have come before. Is that a problem for a lot of the tracks that we're talking about that get criticism, like Don't Shoot Shotgun and Excitable? Is it just a case of what's come before was simply too strong?
I think so, yeah. I think, you know, if you look at most albums, especially from that genre of music and that period, I mean, most bands you'd be lucky if you got three singles, you know. Most bands might have just like one big single, but, you know, the fact they had seven, and not just, like you said, small singles, they're all massive singles. And when you've got that level of, you know, songwriting, you know, I think anything that is not quite, even in stuff, it can be like 96% there, but, you know, when compared to the rest of it, it's kind of, it's viewed badly on, I guess. But I certainly don't think, I mean, there is any bad songs on the album. I think they're just a little bit, you know, songs like, I think Don't Shoot is a good song. I think Excitable is really the only one for me that doesn't quite level up, but it's just because everything else is so damn good on the album, you know.
So we'll get to our final track, which is Love and Affection. So in some ways, this is regarded as the single that never was. They performed it live before the album came out, and the demand was there, but it was never released. How do you think it would have fared as potentially the eighth single off the album?
I think it would have done all right. I mean, it's kind of, to me, it's very much, again, it's very much like an AOR song, so it kind of has more of a kind of Animal vibe, but I don't think it's as instant as Animal. It's kind of like I think it brings the album perfectly to a close, you know what I mean? We were talking about earlier about kind of starting off with Women, and then it kind of builds up to Rocket, and then we go up on this kind of, literally on this sort of like roller coaster of sort of emotions, and we drop down for Love Bites, we come back up for Pour Some Sugar, and start side two with Gods of War, and then, you know, I think it brings the album to a perfect close. I think Run Riot would have been a better single. I'm not sure how it would have done. I mean, Love and Affection kind of also has that kind of Hysteria type vibe, but I don't think it's anywhere near as good a song as Hysteria. But the thing with this song is that I always thought, from, you know, pretty much the first few times I heard it to me, it's very Bryan Adams, you know. It sounds, which I know, you know, the album after this, Adrenalize, I mean, And Bryan Adams did an album called Waking Up the Neighbours in kind of 92, 93, which there's some very, very strong similarities to it, which I'd never really heard before. They're in abundance on Adrenalize, but on this album, I think I can totally hear Bryan Adams having a, like I could hear like one of the pop artists having a big single with Excitable. I could definitely hear Bryan Adams, like, or someone like him, having a big single with Love and Affection, you know. But I think it brings the album nicely to a close, you know. It just kind of completes the picture, you know what I mean? It kind of, it just ends everything nicely, and then, you know, and then you turn the cassette over and you play it again.
And I guess from what you're saying as well is that Love and Affection, because it's got that kind of Bryan Adams-y sound, maybe touches of Adrenalize, it's almost kind of a sign of what's to come for the future of Def Leppard, now that kind of hysteria's closed, and we'd have to wait another few years before Adrenalize came out.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was a sign of things to come. I think, you know, and Adrenalize, I mean, Adrenalize was a great album, you know, but it clearly didn't have the, you know, it wasn't such a big event that Hysteria was. Adrenalize was a lot more just, let's just get straight to the point, you know, let's just play the songs. You know, the songs are all, you know, 3.5-4 minutes long on Adrenalize. You know, there's no, you know, explosions, there's no samples. It's just more of a straight ahead, here's the songs, check them out sort of thing. And I think Love and Affection kind of leads on to kind of where they went in 92 with Adrenalize.
Hysteria is an album bursting at the seams with hit singles, powerful harmonies and killer guitar solos. Beyond that, why do you think that 30 years on that Hysteria stood the test of time?
I think it's because I think it's like one of those albums that comes along every now and then that kind of sums up a generation, you know, and it sums up, like, you know, classic albums always have, you know, I think nowadays so many albums, you know, production's great nowadays, but so many bands sound exactly the same, and you can't tell one band from another because the drum sounds the same on every album, the guitar sounds, everyone's using the same plugins and stuff like that, and so the actual uniqueness and the individuality of bands is so, you know, is non-existent nowadays, whereas back in the day it was a little bit. But I think when you listen to, you know, classic albums, you instantly know who the band is. You know, you listen to AC/DC, Back in Black, you listen to, you know, Appetite for Destruction. You know, I mean, there's a million albums. I think Def Leppard is in, you know, Hysteria is in with, you know, those albums. It sums up 80s rock, you know. If there's ever an album to sum up, you know, and then anybody ever said, well, what, you know, what is 80s rock, what does it sound like, you know, what's the songwriting, what's the production like, this is just defines an era, really. And I think even years, you know, years to come, like I said, now, I mean, I listened to it the other day and it just still sounds, 30 years on, it just still sounds absolutely incredible. And I don't think it's ever really going to, you know, go down from that. You know, I think it's just on that level that, you know, very, very few bands can get to, you know.
And finally, why is Hysteria your classic album? And why, if people haven't already, why should they check it out?
Just down to the songs. It's, you know, for me, I'm all about, you know, great, great songs. If you're looking for an album that just has from start to finish, you know, there's just killer song after killer song after killer song. You know, there's a lot of albums that came before this and have come after it that I absolutely love with great songs, but, you know, nothing can get to, you know, nothing can beat this. I don't think any album will ever come along for me personally that will be a better sounding album and a better album, you know, songwriting wise. I think it's just genius. It really is.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to join me. I've thoroughly enjoyed myself. I just wanted to touch on before we go, you'd been talking about your new band, Midnight City, and kind of that your first album is out later this year. So I just wanted to hear a bit more about that, if that was okay.
I've got a band called Midnight City. We're signed to AOR Heaven. And we've got an album coming out in October, which is, we're actually planning the release date around the Rockingham weekend, which is coming up in Nottingham. towards the end of October. So yeah, we've got that album coming out, so I'd hasten, you know, I'd definitely tell people, you know, if you love Def Leppard, you love Bon Jovi, Danger Danger, all the kind of all the great 80s hair metal bands, you should really, really like Midnight City, because it's a blatant hair metal album of the highest order. So yeah, we got that album coming out in October. We're going to be playing a release party in Nottingham, and then we're going to be playing a bunch of festivals next year, one of which I can tell you about, which is that we're playing a Hard Rock Hell AOR festival in Wales next March, and hopefully doing stuff out in Europe as well. So we've got that going on. You can check us out. We've actually just launched the Facebook page today, actually. So just go and check out. I think it's Midnight City UK. And I also got some stuff coming up with Tiger Tales. We're playing the Hard Rock Hell Sleaze show in September, and then we're doing a big benefit concert for Pepsi Tate, who passed away 10 years ago. That's in Nottingham in September as well. So, but you can check all that out on the Facebook and all the usual places. So
cool, and I'll have all those details on the My Classic Album Facebook page as well. So
that's awesome, man. Yeah, I've loved it, man. Thanks for chatting, everybody. I've really enjoyed this.
Huge thanks to Rob Wild for taking the time out to chill with me, talk about an awesome album in Def Leppard's Hysteria, and to celebrate 30 years of Hysteria. As Rob was touching on there, he's got a new band along with Tiger Tales, Midnight City, and they're releasing their debut album in October. If you're in the Nottingham area, you can get there. Midnight City are having an album release show at the Tap and Tumbler in Nottingham on Friday, October the 20th. Now, if you get yourself over to their Facebook page, Midnight City UK, you can hear snippets of the new album. They are floating around on there. And I must say, if you're a fan of Def Leppard and that kind of melodic pop metal, you will really enjoy what Midnight City have to offer. As for Tiger Tales, they are going to be playing a very special show in Nottingham on September the 16th. To remember Pepsi Tate, who passed away 10 years ago, and all the money from that show will be going towards research for pancreatic cancer. So if you get yourselves to rescuerooms.com, you can still get tickets for that, and they're £12.50. If you missed any of that, don't worry, all that information will be at myclassicalbum.co.uk and on our Facebook page. So get yourself like on Facebook, My Classic Album with Mike Norris. Follow us on Instagram, My Classic Album Podcast, or you can follow us on Twitter at MCA_podcast. So there's just one more piece of business to take care of before we wind it up for another episode of My Classic Album. So you, the listeners of My Classic Album, have been voting for your favourite Def Leppard song from Hysteria. And I'm happy to announce that the song you have voted for is Gods of War, which was pretty cool. I was thinking it might have been one of the big singles, but I think Gods of War is a really cool track on the album, you know, as me and Rob talked about. So congratulations to Gods of War for being My Classic Album's track of Hysteria. And that's pretty much it. Now, Def Leppard fans may recognise the name Mark Danzeisen. Now, Mark Danzeisen has appeared doing backing vocals on a few Def Leppard albums, but he's also in Vivian Campbell's band River Dogs. And Mark will be the guest on the next episode of My Classic Album, which will actually only be in 2 weeks' time instead of in September. On the 16th of August, I'll be welcoming Mark onto the show. I will be talking about Stevie Wonder's Fulfillingness's first finale. And I really enjoyed my time chatting with Mark, as I do with all the guests on My Classic Album. And Mark was kind enough to say on Instagram that it was one of his favourite interviews and discussions that he'd ever had on anything like this before. So it is, don't miss. So that's on the 16th of August rather than the 1st of September. But on the 1st of September, my special guest will be Big Boy Bloater, who is a phenomenal blues singer from here in the UK. And he chose Blondie's Parallel Lines. So that's coming up on the 1st of September. We've got Mark Danzeisen on the 16th of August. So plenty to get you through the next month. So until then, I've been Mike Norris, and I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Cheers!